welcome back. I'm your host, Rillian. I apologize for the long wait between episodes. It's been really crazy in my life recently, but hopefully with school being over, that will be, we'll see more regular episodes here. We're going to go ahead and jump right into our news with Glumpuddle, and welcome, Glumpuddle. Good to have you back.
Good to be back. It's been a while, but we're back.
Yeah, and I apologize for a long wait between episodes. It's been really crazy with school and everything, but hopefully that'll change now. What we're going to do today, because there's been so much news, we are not going to talk about all the news. What we're going to talk about specifically are the production blogs that have been released on the official website, Narnia.com. And also, we're going to talk about the little bit of news on Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And Glumpuddle, do you want to tell us about that?
It's that Michael Apted has been chosen to direct it, which I think they met with a, not surprisingly, a pretty overall good response. My initial response was kind of negative, just because I didn't know much about him. All I knew was that he directed Amazing Grace, and so my thought was, oh, they've just pulled some Walden director they happen to have a good relationship with. But I looked into it more, and he actually has done a lot of films, a lot of which are a lot bigger than Amazing Grace. And overall, I liked Amazing Grace, and thought he did a good job with the characters and the whole feel and look of the film. And so now, after pondering it for a while, I do feel pretty good about him. I mean, I felt really good about Adamson right from the beginning. And this guy I was kind of iffy about. Now I feel pretty good about him, which is a good feeling since Dawn Treader is my favorite book.
Yeah, ironically, I think it's kind of funny. The fact that I don't know much about this director, it kind of assures me in a way, because it tells me that they're probably that they're going for talent rather than a big name director, which is the right way to go. And even in the first film, Andrew Adamson was not a household name, although people had seen the Shrek film. So that was the direction they went with the first film, which I thought was a great idea. But I think they also are casting now for Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Is that correct?
Well, we know that, casting for Voyage of the Dawn Treader started, and that's pretty much all we know. We don't know exactly who they're looking for at the moment, but I'm sure they look for, you know, Eustace and Drinian and all that, but we don't really know exactly what's going on. But the most interesting part of this report is that it has kind of a little synopsis of the movie, and it looks really close to the book. I mean, obviously they don't go into details, but it's just encouraging to see that, you know, some of the things like, you know, the Dark Island and the Duffel Puds are going to be in the film. And so there's a couple of nitpicky things, like it says sea serpents, plural. And so is there going to be more than one sea serpent in the movie, or is that nothing, you know? So that's kind of, but overall it looks, you know, close to the book. Overall it seems pretty encouraging.
Yeah, I'm honestly not too sure. Looking at the sea serpent battle in the book, I'm not sure it would translate too well straight into film, and that's why I wonder if they're going to change some things here and there, like maybe have multiple sea serpents, or even I don't know, I suppose there's a possibility of them combining the sea serpent battle with the mer people.
I don't really like the sound of that idea. I mean, I like the sea serpent battle in the book. It's funny how to hear Reepy Chief suddenly shout, "Everyone stop fighting," and that's what gets people's attention. And so I just love the sort of the humor of hearing that character of all people say stop fighting. And the sea people are just kind of, they're not so much an event in the book. It's, to me, it's just sort of a sign that, wow, they really are getting into unknown lands, and they really are seeing things that few people have seen before. And I would much rather them spend more time on, like, the Island of the Voices or the Dark Island or Deathwater or something like that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually. I was wondering on your thoughts on this. A few people know that there are actually two different endings for the chapter of the Dark Island in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, depending on which version of the book you read, whether it be the original British version or the American edition, which Lewis revised and changed the ending. And do you think that the filmmakers are going to go with the original ending of the island just being destroyed and kind of disappearing, or will they end it with the revised ending of the Dawn Treader just escaping and the island still exists?
I would expect them, because what happened is, they had the original British version of the story, which had that had the Dark Island fading away and like being destroyed, and then in the American edition, they had what you said, where it wasn't destroyed, and they had some of the dialogue was different. But then in 1994, HarperCollins decided to go back to using the original British edition. So that American edition where the Dark Island isn't destroyed hasn't even been in print since 1994, as far as I know. So for that reason, I would expect them to stick with the original ending where the Dark Island is destroyed.
Yeah, well, that's probably what they'll do. And I would be surprised if Adamson had read the American edition of Voyage before the British version.
Yeah. Well, of course, Adamson, we're not, he's producing it, he's co-producing it, I believe, but he's not, he obviously won't be as involved with it as the other films.
But Adamson is still in the picture for
Right,
Voyage.
right. And they could possibly take the two endings and combine them, I think. I think that would be difficult, because there's some different dialogue as well, and where, like, in one of them, the Lord Roop, he says, never bring me back here again. And I believe in another ending, he said, never ask me what happened while I was here, because it's just too horrible for him to say.
Yeah, well, I always liked it better in this revised version where he just says, "Don't ask me about it," because I thought the first one made very little sense. Why would Caspian bring him back there?
Yeah, but like I said before, the original ending has him just saying, don't ever bring me back here again. And the other one's not really even in print anymore. So I would. If they're going to stick with one, I would expect them to stick with that one.
Well, let's move on and talk about the production blogs. There have been three. And we're going to talk about the first one very briefly for maybe 30 to 40 seconds here, because but it just showed some behind the scenes footage of Caraparvel and real quick Glumpuddle, what are your thoughts on the Caraparvel set from what you've seen in the video and in the set pictures? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, and like you said, we don't really see much of them, so it's hard to say. I can kind of comment on, I think, the location where it's shot. And I always imagined the ruins of Caer Paravel to be basically a tangled mess, because, no one's touched them for a 1,000 years. And so it's just totally overgrown mess. And I think, the book kind of leads to that idea as well. And these locations, I think, much like the locations in the first film, they seem very kind of clean, nice, and beautiful looking, and that doesn't seem very appropriate for the Caer Paravel ruins, sort of this, something that's been totally undisturbed for about 1,300 years. But we don't get we only get a few. This is just one very tiny glimpse of things that aren't even that's just for a behind the scenes thing. We're not even looking at the finished film. But those were kind of my initial reactions watching it.
Yeah, I've been pretty pleased personally. I thought it looked appropriately overgrown, and it's important that it's overgrown because it should take the children a while to realize they're in a castle, much less that it's Caer Paravel. So they
Right.
have to be very unaware of that. But I did think it would be a lot more expansive than what we've seen. I expected it to look taller and more like a real large castle site once they get a good look at it.
We don't know what they're going to add with. They might add something with visual effects. There's
True,
this might be
true.
just a little piece of what we're actually going to see in the final film. It's really the trees that, caught my eye. The forest doesn't seem very tangled and overgrown as I had imagined. It seems quite clean and maybe even well tended, honestly.
Well, the fact that it has a film crew on it is going to change some aspects of how well tended it looks. Although I didn't think it looked too well tended. I mean, I remember one screenshot where you see a huge tree growing up right in the middle of an archway, which I liked, but maybe we're being too
Oh, my
nitpicky.
favorite.
Yeah, but I've been pretty pleased. I don't think it looks too well
Right.
tended.
In that blog, this isn't the finished film. It's just little tiny glimpses on the behind the scenes thing, but so it's dangerous to read into it, but it's fun too anyway.
Well, I say bring on the danger.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's talk about Howard Berger's production blog.
Good idea.
Well, yeah, he wrote one of the blog entries, and I thought it was kind of interesting, nothing too spectacular or groundbreaking, although he did say one thing that I definitely noticed, and that is where he said that he wants to definitely show female dwarves in Prince Caspian. And I thought that was interesting because, as far as I know, I have never seen any movie, fantasy or otherwise, really, with female dwarves.
That is interesting, and of course, in the Two Towers movie, they kind of make a joke about that, where he says, and some people thought that dwarves just spring out of holes in the ground, but I've never, you're right, never actually seen a movie with female dwarves.
Yeah, then again, maybe we have seen female dwarves in movies, we just didn't know they were female dwarves.
Well, who knows? Yeah, it's the beards, as Aragorn would say.
It's the beards. Yeah, well, actually, this is something I don't think it was brought up in Howard Berger's entry, but it's worth mentioning. Somewhere we learned that there are going to be Minotaurs, I think with one of the casting announcements, there's going to be Minotaurs with Caspian. And some fans really don't like that the Minotaurs, which were the bad guys in the first film, are going to be the good guys here. And before I say anything about it, what do you think? What are your
Well,
thoughts?
yeah, that is something that came out when the character called Asterius was cast. He's not a character in the book, and they said he fights on Miraz's side. And now Howard Berger talks about it here. And my initial reaction is I'm very uncomfortable with that, just because there aren't any examples of good Minotaurs in Narnia. And I know it's not really politically correct, but I think there is more evidence in the Chronicles that suggests that there are races of beings that are just bad and races of beings that are just good. And it's possible that the Minotaurs will turn bad along with the hag and the werewolf in the sorcery and sudden vengeance scene. But I think Berger kind of implies here that that's not what we're going to see. And he also says Minotaurs, plural, so there's apparently going to be more than one. But basically, I'm uncomfortable with it because of the scene in Prince Caspian where Nycteric, I believe, or someone suggests that, oh, there's an ogre or two, and we should go and see if they want to join our army. And Caspian and the others, they don't say, well, what's their personality like? They just immediately say, no, absolutely not. We would not have Aslan for a friend if we brought in that rabble. And for that reason, I'm uncomfortable with this idea. It isn't a big deal. It's just something that, I personally am not comfortable with.
Yeah. I do not have a big problem with it, and here's why. In the book, there are different kind of standards for different races. You have the centaurs, which are always considered to be kind of the good race, and they're always noble, never siding with evil. And then you have the hags and the werewolves, and those creatures are a little different, but the wolves and the black dwarves, and I think the minotaurs as well, also fit into this kind of area where it's more shady, and the black dwarves weren't always with evil. They were sometimes on the right side, and even in the case of Prince Caspian, it's not all the black dwarves that go against Caspian in the end, it's just Nycteric. So I don't think this will be a big problem, and also if the writers keep this in mind with the Minotaurs being a questionable ally, I don't think it will do any damage, and they may not end up being final allies. They may end up being more along the lines of the werewolf and the hag. We simply don't know this early on, but that is why I don't really see a huge problem with it.
Right. Like I said before, it's just something I'm kind of uncomfortable with. And there aren't ex any examples of good Minotaurs in the Chronicles. I think that they might be trying to expand on that idea of the army questioning, who's really on their side, which is kind of a little tiny thing in the sorcery and sudden vengeance scene where there's Nycteric, there's the treason of Nycteric and the others. And a scene where I think it's Truffle Hunter accuses Nick of being, quote, the blab. And so I wonder if maybe they're kind of really expanding on that little idea in the book of we're not really sure if maybe traitors in our army. And if the Minotaurs turn bad in the end, I wouldn't have a problem at all. I think that'd be
Ha ha ha.
That'd be kind of a cool way, just expanding on that idea that's in the book. And since Minotaurs, I thought, turned out so well in the first film, I think it'd be great to bring them back. But obviously, that's probably that's the main motivation. And that's one of the things that Douglas Gresham mentioned when he was asked about this, was that he, you know, did they just like Minotaurs? And he had other reasons as well. But if they turn bad in the end, I don't think I would have a problem with this at
Yeah, what
all.
was it William Moseley said in the commentary? Only General Ottman can turn a cow's moo into a battle cry for war.
That's right.
Well, let's move on and talk about the final production blog entry from May. Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, who are the co-screenwriters, wrote this one. And I want to talk about this one because it has some very interesting revelations in it and some things I have some very strong feelings about. So why don't you real quick give us a rundown?
Okay, you're right. They do have some pretty interesting things in here, and they kind of cut right to the chase in this blog with the big nagging problem in Prince Caspian. And he says that the biggest challenge they faced was connecting the Pevensey story to the story of Prince Caspian, and talk about how in the book there's separate narratives and they come together at the end. And but they want to try to connect their stories as soon as possible, and this raises the question, at what time do the Pevenseys meet Caspian? I mean, could they perhaps meet him maybe before the Dancing Lawn, maybe earlier? I mean, maybe they actually fight with Caspian for a while, and then Peter says, "Oh, let's challenge Miraz to single combat." And there was a rumor before that they blow the horn earlier, like as Caspian is fleeing the castle, he actually blows the horn, and that would enable and Trumpkin maybe is actually captured, and that's how he gets to meet the Pevenseys. But there's a lot of holes in that. We're not sure if that's true or anything, but it would mean that the Pevenseys would get called into Narnia earlier than they do in the book, and could possibly meet up with Caspian sooner. So we're just kind of trying to. I'm just kind of wondering, you know, at what point do they meet him, and how do they connect them so early? And this is the big nagging problem with Prince Caspian. This might be a clue as to how they've approached it.
Yeah, well, you know me. I'm not. I'm something of a purist. I do not care too much about details in books, in translating books to movies. For instance, you know the Frozen River scene. I didn't have so much of a problem with, unlike you. However, for themes that I feel are going to be changed, I have a very big problem with changes there, and that's why you know the single line from Father Christmas in the first film, the hope that you have brought your majesties has weakened the witch's power. That just irks me because it's not like how it was in the book. So, but here I think that the writers can make the necessary changes because it is going to be difficult to translate Caspian for the big screen. I realize that probably of all the books, it's going to be the most difficult, and there will have to be changes, and I'm willing to accept that. But I think they can change, make the necessary changes without changing the themes. And you know, you said you brought up the possibility of them joining Caspian before the Dancing Lawn sequence, and I think it's imperative that Caspian fight Miraz and lose, have losses before the Pevensies join him. Otherwise, you know, at the very end, you know, well, hey, thanks for helping me fight my evil uncle, but you know, maybe I could have done it without you. I don't know. So it can't be a situation like that. Caspian has to absolutely know that he can't do it without the Pevensies. And I think that if they play the book, play the story according to how the book did it, and then perhaps emphasize a lot more on the part of the story where they actually are with Caspian, and maybe even add some material there that's in keeping with the themes of the book, they don't have to change so much. They can just put more emphasis later on, so that there's still a lot of screen time where they are with Caspian. So, you know, I think playing it like that would be a way to do it without changing too much of the thematic elements.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's important for Caspian to really understand that we have almost no hope of winning. And then right there, when they're at the end of their rope, like these figures from legend and myth from the ancient past return and save the day. That's just such an interesting original concept, I think. And that is an important story point.
Especially since there is so much character development in the first few chapters of the book with the Pevensies. And also the whole issue with Aslan being there, Aslan and Lucy and Aslan leading them, that is a huge part of the book and has so many important elements there that I would hate it if that was cut out or shortened at all to make room for maybe something that wasn't even in the book. Especially since you get the sense that Aslan, throughout all the chronicles, though he's mostly in line with the wardrobe, is the orchestrator of all these events that are taking
In
place.
a sense, yeah.
So that is something that I'm hoping, that's why one reason why I hope that the beginning of the book isn't cut out or changed too much.
Yeah, and it's also just such a memorable scene in the book, and kind of showing about Lucy and Aslan kind of having this special relationship. And that's one of the scenes, you know, when you say Prince Caspian, that's one of the first scenes that comes into my mind. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the iconic scenes in the entire series.
Well, this leads into another issue that I was thinking about. The writers brought up the idea of one thing they want to do is to show how the Pevensies have had trouble adapting back into our world as going from kings and queens with kingdom to being school children with homework. And they wanted to show the transition there. And I feel good and bad about it. I feel good about it in the way that it's interesting. It builds, it shows some interesting little ideas, and it could lead into some character development with Susan that will become important later. But the problem I have is, okay, you want to, change, the story so that Caspian and the Pevensies meet sooner. Okay, fine, but why are you adding all this stuff at the beginning? So they're trying to come up with ways to shorten the parts of the one part of the book, and then they're adding stuff that wasn't even in the book, and it just seems like they're handicapping themselves, and they have these two different ideas that are really going to go against each other and cause problems. And in one way, I think this change seems kind of superfluous.
I would generally agree with that, and I don't really see how they can spend too much
Whoa,
time.
you're agreeing with me? Wow.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, and I would say that I don't see how they can spend too much time on beginning. I mean, maybe it's something to like kind of reference to, and maybe it's the fact that they're really going to make a big deal about them, how they return to the environment they live so long in. And now they're, which is of course a big theme of Prince Caspian. The subtitle, after all, is The Return to Narnia. And so maybe it's more about how they've been uncomfortable with being, you know, in their old world for a while, but now they're like coming back. So I wonder if they're going to focus on that aspect of it. But you know, I think that in general, the reason, you know, they're right, Lewis doesn't really touch on this much. The reason is because it's largely irrelevant to the story. It isn't really about the journey of a king back into a kid. It's about a kid becoming a king, or in this case, a kid returning to be a king. That's kind of the interesting part of it. And so, as long as they don't make a big like subplot deal of it, that could be just kind of an interesting idea to throw in, just to add to the whole theme of return. But yes, I wouldn't want them to take it too far.
Yeah, in the first film, Adamson said he wanted to change, not really change, but add the sense of how the children are separated from their family. And they did a good job of keeping it kind of short, and they did get the point across. They had it in the opening credits scene, actually, more than anything, is where you get that sense. And I thought it worked well there. And in this, the same case, you don't need to, they don't need to go into a whole lot of crazy. Well, not a lot of exposition on this. So, before we wrap this up, is there anything else in the production blog that stuck out to you that you want to talk about?
I think that is. Let me just take another look at it right here. No, they don't really talk about much more than that. There's one thing they mentioned. They talk about. Let's see. They talk about some of the alliances and antagonisms that would evolve when we toss three kings and two queens together in the same room, and I'm not quite sure what they mean by that. It almost sounds like there's like competition for leadership or something. I'm not quite sure where they're going with that. I mean, that's certainly not in the book. In the book, Peter makes the final decisions, and that's it. He's the High King. Even Caspian immediately steps aside, and Peter has to tell him, you know, I've come here to put you into the throne, not to take your place. And so I'm curious to see.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just kind of,
Yeah,
yeah.
I wouldn't be too worried about it. At least for me, when I think of that, I think of the part where Caspian wants to fight Miraz in the duel. And, well, not exactly a duel,
Yeah.
in the one-on-one fight. And then, of course, Peter has to tell him, no, it's not proper. It's my place to fight him. You're the rightful heir to the throne. I'm fighting for you. That's my reason for being here. It's my job to fight Miraz. I think the filmmakers know that it wouldn't work for him to go, hey, I'm here to help you. I'm Peter, and I'll do as I say. I'm your
Yeah.
boss. But I think that it can be done well. I don't think that the blog will dictate that much. Well, we have pretty much done now, and we've covered a lot of the news. I think we did a good job, at least covering most of the most important news that was out there and available.
At least the big stuff. There's a ton of pictures from the set online. There's a
Yes, everyone go to the website and look at the pictures and listen to the, well, not listen.
So you
You're
can listen
listening now.
too. You're listening right now.
Yeah, you're listening now. So, but yeah, go ahead, look at the pictures. We did not at all cover all of the news.
Oh yeah, there's plenty of pictures, and Narnie Web has an exclusive interview with Douglas Gresham. It has a couple interesting little tidbits in it.
So check it
There's
out and catch
a
up
lot
on
going
all the
on.
news. And Glumpuddle, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Well, everyone, that wraps up this episode. Thank you very much for joining us. If you would like to email me with your thoughts, you can email me at rillian@narnieweb.com. Or if you want to email Glumpuddle, you can email him at glumpuddle@narnieweb.com. You've been listening to the Narnia Web Council, and until next time, I'm your host, Rillian. Thanks for listening.